we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2999. And Janet, would you give us a rundown, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2999 was a bill introduced by this committee. It's the first part of session for the Petroleum Marketers Association. And if you can ignore the original bill and focus on the Dash 1 amendments, because the Dash 1 amendments replace the original bill, they've been worked on by the Department of Transportation with the proponents of the bill. And they authorize the Department of Transportation to provide a refund of motor vehicle fuel, and we're talking about gasoline, not diesel in this case, paid by fuel dealers for their uncollectible accounts. The amendments change the designee of the refund from the broker language to a dealer, and they clarify the circumstances necessary to qualify for the refund. Requires the dealer to declare the account uncollectible and declare that it meets the standards for deductibility for federal income tax purposes. It also specifies that to qualify for a refund, the dealer may not have previously received a refund from the department for taxes not paid by the same purchaser. And finally, it provides that if a dealer receives a refund and subsequently collects any amount of the account, the collected amount shall be apportioned between the fuel tax portion and the fuel portion, and the fuel tax portion would be returned to the department. Mr. Chair, the proponents of the bill are here. The Department of Transportation is here if there are any questions. And this bill does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Janet. Cliff Olson and Paul Romaine, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. With me is Cliff Olson, who is with Mark Nelson Oil Products, Salem Company, and he is head of our legislative committee for the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. I can answer any questions. I do. I'm glad that your committee administrator explained that you are not to look at the original bill, because I think the person drafting the original bill was drinking some of my other client's products at the time that the bill was drafted. And the summary had just about everybody in the entire Capitol a little bit concerned when it said below-cost sales, but it has nothing to do with anything concerning below-cost sales. All this is very simply, when we sell motor vehicle fuel, and it is both gasoline and diesel, it is not just gasoline. We wanted to make sure that's out there. It applies to gasoline and diesel. When we sell the fuel to somebody who is reselling it, we have already paid the tax on that to the state, and we collect the tax from that person, or we sell it to them on credit. We collect, wait for the tax to come in as they pay us. If they go out of business, then we're left holding the bag, not only for the fuel, which is our problem, but also we've now paid the state the tax, and we haven't been able to collect the tax. So what this does is at least give us an opportunity to apply for a refund of just simply the tax portion. Nothing else, just the tax portion. It also keeps the incentive for us to go after the person, because the lion's share of what would be owed to us is not tax, it's for the fuel itself. The bill does have a subsequent referral to revenue. It's the right thing to do. It sets up the proper procedure. Is it something that we will get all the way through the process, given the short funds that you have? It's a very small amount, really, that we're talking about. You collect about $405 million in fuel taxes, and we figure this is probably original estimates were about, I think they were saying, Department of Transportation was saying $50,000, but we think it's probably about $250,000 or so in that range. Is that a big number over the overall picture? No, but today's climate, who knows? But what we would ask you to do is pass the bill on to revenue as amended, and then we can discuss the fiscal implications over in revenue committee where everybody will sort of be together. Would be Cliff, I don't know, did I blow anything there? Oh, by the way, the Department of Transportation is in favor, or they're fine with the bill, and we worked with them on it. Again, great relationship with them and worked with them so that they're working on it, helped us. And they will not be coming up to testify because they're afraid of you.
We really need them.
Paul, the $250,000, is that tax or is that the total value of the fuel, tax and the cost of fuel?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's sort of a rough estimate of the tax that would be. Of the $405 million you collect in tax, we figure there's about $250,000 that in effect becomes uncollectible by us out there. So that's the figure. To the state, it's not a huge number. To a small marketer, you know, you get $10,000 worth of tax or something like that, that's a big number. So that's why we're asking for it.
When they fail to pay you guys for your fuel and the taxes, is there any opportunity to go get the fuel back before they sell it all? Or you learn about it after the fact?
Chair Brown, no, that's generally after the fact. Most of the people are consuming that fuel within, you know, 3 to 5 days. Usually their terms are net 10 to 15 days, sometimes 30 days in the case of some customers. So usually the fuel's well gone by the time we're able to determine that they're not going to pay the bill. Of course, that affects how much credit we extend in the future, but that portion is gone at that point. And I might add on the figures that we increased those because we've just gone through a period of very difficult times in the state, as you all know, and a lot of contractors, truckers, and some of the people, other industries, have gone out of business. So that's given us kind of a bump in that issue. But with tightened credit and change in the times, we feel the number will move towards the lower side.
Is there any opportunity to reclaim the tax dollars lost through leaning anything else that have a value?
Oh. We generally, Chair Brown, we generally do that in some manner. Most everyone will pursue because we have, you know, 3/4 or more of the interest in the bill, so we usually pursue a collection of some sort. Sometimes these end up in bankruptcy, no assets, so there's no way that we can, you know, nothing that we can go after. But we, everybody that I know of, pursues those to the full amount because it is a burden on, you know, on our bottom line.
Yeah, we, Mr. Chair, we are the ones with the financial incentive to pursue it. I mean, it's anything we pursue that we would collect, you would get, the state would get the tax portion of that, whatever we happen to collect.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, yeah, what's the rate of tax you pay on the 6%, 2%, 1%? I mean, what?
The tax amount right now is 24 cents a gallon on motor vehicle fuel, gasoline,
and diesel.
So you've got another 75% out there, or
75% at least. Actually, nowadays
you've got to collect from the other dealers.
Exactly. Nowadays, you've got a heck of a lot more than 3/4. I mean,
the federal road tax. Then do you you still have to collect it and remit it? Then
that's correct.
Yeah. Representative Mabry.
I have made probably a series of questions. I'm not convinced that this is a good bill. I'm not convinced that just because transportation bought off on it that we should. And the reason, I guess, the reason, who makes the decision to extend credit to John Mabry?
The dealer, Chairman Brown. Vice Chairman Mabry, the dealer would make that decision.
Right.
And again, it's, since we have the biggest stake in it, You know, we're not going to. This doesn't give the dealer any incentive to make looser credit decisions because we're still on the hook for the majority.
Well, I understand
of it.
That, but the state has not participated in that credit decision at all. I mean, it strikes me as a similar situation that if I'm inclined to take my paycheck at the end of the month and go to a casino and gamble it all away, then I should be able to come to the state and say, well, gee, I don't have that money anymore. I shouldn't have to pay income tax on it. That was because I made a poor decision to gamble my paycheck away. If a dealer makes a poor credit decision to extend credit to someone, you know, the state is being asked to participate in that poor decision when they were not a participant in the beginning. And I just, you know, it strikes me as a poor way to conduct business. If I'm a wheat farmer and I ship a barge load of wheat to the port of Portland and the ultimate customer doesn't pay for that wheat, should the barge company not be paid for their transportation costs? I think they probably should. And you know the price of the fuel when you buy it, it includes the tax. And to ask the state to participate, I just, you know, that doesn't make sense to me. You're going to have to do a better selling job.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I don't know if I can do a better selling job or not because we're not trying to sell this to you, but actually, we are the state's tax collector. In effect, what we're doing is sort of acting as a middleman to get the fuel out there. We could go to an all cash situation. I do am very familiar with that scenario through other clients, and it does avoid any kind of tax problem. And you do have a very valid point about why should the state participate in this situation. What we're saying to you is we're not asking you to share the risk of our decision to sell the fuel. It's the fuel cost itself, but the portion that benefits the state itself, we're saying it's that's a portion of the bill that we are acting on your behalf. We're trying to get fuel out to as many people as possible. Some people really you can't. It's an essential commodity, basically. There's a lot of places, especially in smaller towns, where you are not going to be able to get the fuel out there if you do it on a cash basis. It's too big of a number. You're not going to get people to buy it. You force some of the smaller dealers out there to close up. So in this situation, because of the commodity itself, we think it's something the state should participate in. If it was something that was not essential, like beer, I would say the state shouldn't participate in it. But this is something that's an essential commodity. We need to be able to get it out to as many areas as possible, and we need to take a little more risk.
Follow?
Yeah, and my I guess my retort to that, I don't mean this to be a debate, but I guess it is kind of. My retort to that is you know the tax is a part of the cost of the fuel, just like transportation is, just like distilling is, just. You know, all of those things. And the only reason the state collects that tax is to provide roads and bridges and what have you to the public. And just because somebody didn't pay for it doesn't mean they didn't drive over those bridges and highways. And again, for a credit decision that was made without the state's participation. It wasn't the state that issued the credit. It was someone else, not a party to that. That just strikes me as poor business choice. That would be the last of my comments, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other questions? Don't see any. I guess that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the Department of Transportation... You're shaking head up and down, or it's like, okay. All right, we'll close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2999. And we have the the amendments, it essentially is the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Zahner.
I make a motion we accept the Dash 1 amendments to 2999.
Representative Zahner moves the Dash 1 amendments to 2999. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? They're adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zahner.
I move House Bill 2999 as amended to the floor. Oh, we got to go to
revenue.
To revenue with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner moves 2999 as amended to revenue. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilman.
I'll give a courtesy vote for this. I tend to agree with Representative Mabry. I'm not sure I support the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if people might be more comfortable if we just move this bill without a recommendation. And I don't know if there's any. Would that make much difference?
Representative Greenland.
Mr. Chair, you know I can't avoid a debate, so I just wanted to comment on what John said, and I really hate to help out Paul when he hasn't done a good job of explaining things, but I'll make an exception in this case. You know, I was moved with another bill we had where the process is that the tax is collected at the pump rather than the tax is collected at the distributor's level. I mean, the question is somebody is going to act on behalf of the state, because the fact is the driver is going to pay for the gas, the fuel, or for the diesel, and the question is who's moving that money from the driver to the state. And in that situation, I think it was with diesel, where it's collected at the pump and the dealer goes bankrupt and doesn't pay the state. We had that experience, and the state's left holding the bag for the taxes. In this case, it's the middleman that in some way is just simply collecting that tax for the state, and it's the retailers selling it and collecting the tax and going bankrupt with it, and it really does seem a little awkward for the middleman who's acting on our behalf to get stuck when the consumer's paid the tax, the middleman has delivered it, and it's the dealer who's gone bankrupt that's absconding with the money. And it would seem to me at least some participation of the state in that process is not totally inappropriate. So I mean, there is at least some essence, I think, that would describe the logic of this. Well, I definitely agree with you, but bad credit decisions are made, but the state knows the dealer's going out in a market that is being handled on this credit decision and knows the system is depending on that. So there is at least the state's implicit participation in the process, and I just like to debate. So I'll take your side if you want.
Thank you, Representative.
There's no reason to bleed over this bill. I won't. And I can take my lumps and be on the losing side. I can't give it a courtesy vote. It just strikes me wrong. I respect all of you for being wrong.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Zahner, would you consider withdrawing the due pass recommendation?
Well, not really, because I like this from the standpoint that thinking of Representative Mabry's territory, where I used to live out in Wasco and some of those towns, very small dealerships, the job. We make more money as a state by selling more gasoline. And when these guys peddle that gas to these small dealerships and keep them in business, we get that tax revenue. I realize that once in a while one might go out of business, but I want them to be able to deliver as much gas as possible for us to get our tax revenue. So that's why I like this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments? The motion is to move House Bill 2999 as amended to the Revenue Committee. No further discussion. Ryan, will you call the roll?
Representative Dingfelder.
Excuse.
Representative Gilman.
Yes.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
No.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. It's on its way to revenue then. Thank you. let's see. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2933 and Representative Doyle. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. 2933 is a bill that is dealing with the motor vehicle accident reports. And the reason for this bill actually came from a couple of different sources. One of them happens to be a constituent I know very well, and talk about that in a little bit. But the basic premise here is that every time that there is a motor vehicle accident that has more than $1,000 damage or bodily injury, there must be an accident report submitted to the state DMV. The issue then comes that when an accident occurs and the property damage is less than $1,000 to one vehicle, but either equals $1,000 or more to another vehicle, that the state has set up its administrative rule so that both parties must report on the accident. And if one party doesn't report on the accident, then they get their license suspended. Well, the concern comes when that one vehicle that did not have $1,000 worth of damage. And in these days, I mean, it may seem rare, but there's a lot of times when damage might only be a couple hundred dollars, or you know, maybe even up $400 or $500, and they get a letter from the DMV that says, we've heard there's been an accident. You need to report if there was more than $1,000 worth of damage, but you don't have to report if it's less than $1,000. And because of their own, mechanism inside the department, they don't tell the person who had the minor damage that the individual on the other side of the accident had damage that was greater than $1,000. So it's the assumption then, the person with the minor damage, you're having to assume that greater damage occurred elsewhere, or that you can make the assumption on the other side saying, well, there was less than $1,000 damage to me, and I just don't report. And all of a sudden, then, the license gets suspended because you failed to report. And I started looking at this issue thinking that, to me, there's something inherently wrong with a state agency having to make basically an innocent party responsible for reporting on an accident that they had minor damage, and that it's the other side that had the greater damage, and it just didn't make sense to me. And so I started exploring this with the DMV, and it's one of those things that as you start asking questions, you wish you hadn't asked them, because it got into other issues. And ultimately what we found, I think, in what seems to be the case here, is that these accident reports are necessary not to build statistics and data, which, I mean, they still do that, but they want to know who is covered by insurance. This is a way to police our citizens to see that they are living up to the mandate for carried insurance. And the only other way to do that is when people get pulled over for any other or any kind of infraction, then the police will ask them that. But in this way, if somebody happens to have an accident, they must prove that they have insurance coverage. And that's just another way, I guess, for the state to kind of keep track of who's carrying insurance or not. And I really didn't want to get into that kind of policy issue because, to me, I think there is a very significant policy discussion there on whether that should be their responsibility or not. And so I started looking at this and saying, well, if the idea is to just get a sense of, you know, when accidents occur, how they occur, when there is damage, certainly at some level. And to me, $1,000 just seems it's a little low nowadays. But a report, report must be generated to the DMV, go through that whole bureaucratic process to just gather data. I look at that and say, well, you know, there's no reason to get both sides of the story, if you will, if there is, you know, a need for an accident report to show how an accident occurred. Let the person who had the damage, let them go ahead and still have the report, but remove the burden from the person that had the minor damage. And that's what I was presenting to you today, is a solution that eliminates basically the need for the individual who does not meet the threshold of their own property damage, that they don't have to file the report. Those who do have the damage, they still have to file it. And if there's bodily injury, I mean, both sides would still have to report. That part doesn't change. But, you know, the whole idea is to kind of lessen the burden of those who just don't have that high of damage, that they then have to waste their time and waste the state's resources as well in just filing reports, that ultimately get to the idea of the data collection. Now, you know, if those of you think that this is a good way to collect information and actually to have the state enforce the insurance requirement, you know, that's kind of a different story, and I would say certainly, if that's the case, you don't want to have any kind of property-level damage. You want to make sure anybody that's involved in any kind of accident, you know, ought to be filing a report to prove they have insurance. But in this case, you know, it seems to me that the intent of the statutes has been more to provide data so that we know if there's, you know, dangerous intersections, dangerous curves, some road hazards that could be corrected. And in essence, you know, they're not there to act as a judge or jury on who was right or wrong in looking at an accident. Excuse me. All they're trying to do is find out that an accident occurred, and just, you know, at least that person's perspective on what the circumstances were for the accident. And if that's the case, you don't need both parties to do this. Now, I did mention there's a little personal angle to this. One of my constituents happened to be my daughter, and she had the exact circumstance that we were talking about. Her, she got involved with an accident, had damage that only amounted to a couple hundred dollars to her car. She got the letter from the DMV saying, we understand that there was an accident and you must file an accident report. And then towards the end of the letter, it's, you know, if damage was less than $1,000, you don't have to file the accident report. And there was no way to know what the damage was to the other side because our insurance wasn't dealing with it. It was solely the other person's insurance company. And it just didn't make sense. And all of a sudden, she's getting a letter saying that her driver's license has been suspended. And, you know, you look at something like that, and as I discuss it with the DMV, their comment basically was, well, maybe we can make the letter more user-friendly. Well, to me, that doesn't get to the issue. You know, the issue isn't, you know, how do we make it easier for them to understand they still have to file a report. It's whether the report is necessary at all. And for that reason, you know, I presented this bill. The other piece of this, excuse me, is that I did make the, I elevated the threshold from $1,000 to $2,500. And when you look back at the number of years that this legislation has been in place, it does have an increase, a CPI type of increase added to it. But $1,000 just is seems to be nowadays getting to be pretty minor damage to cars. And you know, we're not looking to do this in a way that is trying to burden our citizens. It's something that if, you know, it reaches such a high level of damage that the report's necessary, that's when you really start highlighting where the issues are for safety reasons. it's at that point I think that those accidents should be reported, and so I put it instead at the $2,500. So that's kind of what I was looking at. I thought it was kind of a simple bill. The DMV says it's not necessary. In fact, they're even saying, told me that this doesn't fix the concern that I suggested, so I'm anxious to hear why, because they've not given me a reason why it doesn't fix it. But without that, we'll see if you have any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Zoller.
Mr. Chair, Dan, if the other party hadn't filed the accident report, it would have never come up, obviously.
That's correct.
Which insurance company paid? Who was at fault? Was there a company at fault? You had two insurance companies, I assume, your daughters. The reason I ask that question, if, let's say, your daughter wasn't at fault and the damage to his car is more than $1,000 or $2,500, your daughter obviously doesn't want to file the report, because when the insurance company runs a driving record on her, it's going to show that she was involved in an accident. Even if it wasn't her fault, it still shows on her record. And then he files, and he puts her in a bad spot there. Yeah, I guess my question is, it depends who's at fault in the accident. Does that make any sense at all? I'm thinking of the driving record. When the insurance company runs a check every once in a while on their people for driving records, if she didn't file, and if she wasn't at fault, that's fine. They don't care about that. But if she was at fault, even if she didn't have the maximum amount of damage, it should appear on the record. You know what I'm trying
to say? I do. Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Zoller, the report, even that one individual would be submitting, includes place for both people to be named. And as you know, I guess maybe I should make that presumption, but when there's an accident, if you'd ever been in an accident, that's when you're exchanging the information, right? Your insurance information, your name, address, that type of thing. And that still gets put on the vehicle accident report. So, I guess if there was a hit and run, then certainly there'd be no way to know who that other person was, but there wouldn't be under the current system either. So, the idea, though, is that ultimately it still gets reported on who's involved in the accident, and I think it goes on the record at that point. And it still goes. They're not, the DMV is not looking at who's at fault. And it's the insurance companies, they're just looking to know who was involved. And I've talked about this with the insurance company lobbyists, and they had no problem with what I was proposing here. So, I think they still get the information that they need under my proposal.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I like this bill, but because it seems to me one of the things that might happen, I remember an experience many years ago where I was involved in a small accident, a fender bender, a few hundred dollars on both sides, and both of us said, let's just take care of this ourselves, not report to the insurance company. Not report it, and it was under the law, and it made sense, because one of the other functions is to provide data for insurance companies to raise the rates of drivers that have had an accident. And I think moving it to $2,500, I was wondering if you were thinking this has, it seems to me, the ability to allow people to make that kind of decision to handle it privately without insurance at a level that's reasonable.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I guess that wasn't my intention, and I look at that people, what they want to do with their insurance companies and that type of thing will be left up to them, but I understand your point.
Yeah, well, this allows that to happen at a certain mm-hmm. higher level.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative. Okay. Could we have Kelly Taylor, please?
Thank you.
Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Tater with the Department of Transportation. And typically I wear a DMV or motor carrier hat while I'm here because those are the two divisions that I specialize in. But today I'm speaking on behalf of several parts of the department because the accident report data is used by several parts of the department. What the bill does is it does raise the minimum property damage requirement from $1,000 up to $2,500, and it also changes the Oregon law that says all drivers report to just the driver that had the reportable damage report. And Oregon currently has at $1,000, also in its statute, that every 5 years the department will review the consumer price index and raise the threshold to adjust for the consumer price index. And we are just, that 5 year period has just passed, and we are in the process of raising it to $1,100, and that would take care of the consumer price index. Oregon has the highest reporting threshold of all of our neighboring states. And in all the states, it's my understanding that all drivers report. California has about a $500 reporting requirement. I think Washington's is $700, and I think Idaho's is around $700. We are very concerned with the bill in that it will make the very vital information off the crash data unavailable to us for the most part, because the jump in the threshold will reduce the number of reports that we receive, and the fact that only one driver is reporting will also reduce the amount of information received. And the crash data is used to tell us highest crash locations. It helps us design safer road solutions and help us trigger studies where we might need a traffic light, change the speed limit. It's used for bridge design with rail specifications. It's used when we do federal projects. In fact, federal requirements require accident history data to be provided as part of the project. The data has also been used to make some very good changes in Oregon public policy. The team driver law, the accident statistics and data is what you all use to know which hours of the day and things like that to restrict teens, about passenger information with teen drivers, and just the fact that they have a high accident rate. It's been used for other laws. And so we're very concerned that by jumping the limit up to 2,500 and by limiting it to just one driver, that we will not have this very vital information that all parts of the department use. We're also concerned that if only one person is required to report, there will probably be less reporting, especially if that driver is an uninsured driver. If they're already breaking the law, driving without insurance, and they know after this law passes that they're the only ones probably going to report, chances are they're not going to abide by that law if they weren't even abiding by the law that said they should have insurance. That, in summary, is our concerns. We are very concerned with the bill.
Thank you, Kelly. Any questions?
Mr.
Gilman.
Kelly, and I'm sure the legislature used the Consumer Price Index to raise this amount. Was any consideration given to some other index? Because my feeling is cars, price of automobiles and repair of automobiles, it's going up much faster than the consumer price index.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, that's a fairly new change. For many, many years, it was just a threshold in statute, and I think that went in around the 91 or 93 session. And actually, before we were just about ready to raise it from the previous level with the five-year first time, when the legislature made a change, they went ahead and moved it to where it was going to be anyway. So this will be the first time that we've ever actually adjusted it by that. And frankly, I do not know the history of why they picked the consumer price index. Generally, it's just every so many years they go ahead and raise it.
Any other questions? Representative Greenwood.
Kelly, in one of my earlier lives, I was a statistician, and it seems to me that what you're trying to do is to get information about the most dangerous areas, the most dangerous places. except perhaps for sample size, the sampling from only accidents that had damage of 2,500 or more as opposed to 1,000 or more doesn't really change your ability to pick out where the danger, where the hot spots are. Is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, I thought that too, but what I was, when I talked to some of our engineering folks and the folks that deal with the roadway, they say that minor accidents give us a clue where something more serious could happen. There may only be some minor accidents at this point, but it gives them information to prevent the serious accident in the future. So it isn't just the big crashes they need to hear about. It's the more data, the better. That all of it is vital. So.
Representative Johnner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to make sense out of this question. If an uninsured person hits me and he's at fault, number one, and he stays there, I'm going to get him cited, number one, and number two is I'm going to make sure that that's reported to my insurance company. So they don't have any more responsibility to report that one. So I don't know that the argument of whether they're driving insured, it would be reported anyway, because that would be my responsibility. I mean, if a guy hits my car, I'm going to make sure that someone gets that report. I don't know what the hell the other part of that question was. John, I think I got some of your stuff last week. Well, maybe it'll come back to me. I'm rerunning my life here, and I'm down in my childhood when I get to my teenage years.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Chair. Kelly, we could all probably go back to an experience in our past lives here. I was involved in a multi-car accident, and I was driving a relatively big vehicle, and maybe bent my license plate holder on my car, but did significant damage to the car that I hit. And in this scenario, what would be, I mean, I did file, you know, the report, and he did too, but if I didn't have to because I was, you know, I didn't have any damage, but I was still the one that was at fault in this, does that, his report, will that go onto my records? I mean...
Mr. Chair and Representative Beyer, no. Under this bill, only the person with the damage will have an accident recorded on their driver record. It does start skewing a little bit what, you know, when you have something on your record or when you don't. You may have been the one at fault, but you will have nothing on your driving record. We will not use your accident report to place it on my driving record.
Any other questions? Representative Mabry.
Having worked in the automobile business for a while, I think it's almost impossible these days for two cars to come together and not have $1,000 worth of damage. It's just, I mean, you know, headlight doors are $285 by themselves and, you know, things like that without paint. I mean, it's just incredible for me to imagine two cars coming together and not having $1,000 worth of damage. So I guess my question is, should we therefore then require all accidents, all moving accidents? That doesn't make sense. They're going to be moving on the public road, I guess, is what I'm trying to think. Just automatically require an accident report, regardless of the time, because, you know, if I'm involved in a little fender bender and I'm fortunate enough to only have $100 or $200 worth of damage, there's no way for me to really tell what the other guy did, but I have to assume that it's going to be over $1,000. So shouldn't we just remove the minimum altogether or raise it to a reasonable amount?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mabry, we do get reports of accidents that end up not needing to be reported, that they really are under $1,000 damage. So it is possible for cars to collide and have less than $1,000 worth of damage. As to your question about lowering the rate or removing the rate, California's is set at $500. And so, you know, they have a heck of a lot more cars than we do. and probably more accidents, but they've chosen to keep a lower threshold, it may be for the data. So, I mean, it's definitely a policy call.
One more
Jenny's honor.
What about the insurance company? What if they reported all the damage on the accidents directly to you? And the person filed an accident report with an insurance company?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Honor, I don't know what the insurance companies would think about that. I don't know whether I know that parties do exchange information and stay in touch sometimes. I know that different insurance companies contact each other, and that's how people know they're supposed to report. I don't know what kind of a burden that will put on the insurance companies to report to us.
But from a statistical standpoint, it would give you more statistics on what actually does happen, because I've been involved in an accident that's been in my fault. And regardless of what the damage, I say, hey, here's my insurance company. They'll pay for it. Don't file an accident report. If you do, then I have to file one. I don't want it on my record. You don't want it on your record. We'll settle a claim, and it's done. And we do that. Now, that's a violation of the law, I understand now. I should have reported that. But in that case, the insurance company, this was years and years ago. So in this case, the insurance company, if they would have notified DMV and said they had an accident and here's the material damage, at least statistically you'd know what were your records.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Honor, it isn't just the amount of damage. I mean, and actually that isn't the critical part of the report. If the insurance companies were filling out the report, which they probably need their client to do anyway because they weren't there at the scene, the report is available online, so we've tried to make it convenient. You can mail it into DMV. You don't have to go in. It's a two-sided report that has driver information on one side and little sketches of how the accident occurred on the backside. And that's all of that data is what's used. Now, if an insurance company is able to fill all that data out and send it into us, then that would meet the requirement. But it isn't just knowing that there was $1,000 damage. It's things like, were you wearing your seatbelt? Did you have a helmet on and a motorcycle? You've all asked us to gather information on cell phones. There are things like that that come off the data report. It helps us with skid pavement. I mean, all sorts of things that the data is used for. It isn't just that it was reportable or that it was $1,200 or $1,500 damage. It's the data about the accident, how it occurred, where it occurred, time, date, et cetera.
Final follow-up. On that insurance form, though, that information is pretty... They require a lot of that information, how the accident occurred, you know.
Mr. Chair and Representative Honor, again, you know, if they're able to provide the same amount of data and you make it a change from the insurance companies needing to report it, you know, and they're okay with that.
Mr. Chair. Kelly, how do they, you know, if you have, you're involved in an accident, and is the estimate on the amount of damage what the person decides it is, or do they have to get an estimate from a body and fender shop, or can they just eyeball it themselves and say, well, it's $999 worth of damage, so I don't have to?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the exact answer to that question. I'd have to check.
Thank you. Any other questions? And then we'll have no more witnesses, right? We'll close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move 2933 to the floor. Would you pass recommendation?
Representative Greenlick moves House Bill 2933 to the floor, but they do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Blair.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no vote on this. I have some concerns about the high limit on the reporting, and I also have some concerns about the reporting on just one person, whether that person is at fault. I mean, there's some questions there. I wouldn't want... I mean... If I were at fault and didn't have the damage, like my incident talked about, I mean that's great. But if I was the person that wasn't at fault and I had significant damage and it was my record was the only one it went on, I have some major problems with that. So I am a no vote.
Thank you. Any other? Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gilman.
No.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye. Look for coin.
Representative Beyer.
No.
Representative Dingfelder.
Excuse.
Chair Brown.
Aye. And motion carries. Representative Doyle, would you like to be the carrier? Thank you. Which one now? We're down to 3240.
Buyer's concern was the question I was trying to get on.
Well, this doesn't prohibit.
2001 revised the provision increases volume.
Yes.
Okay.
If they were,
I'm going to step out of order a little here and take do a work session on House Bill 2801. It can be moved fairly quickly, I think. And so, committee, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2801. And Janet, can you give us an explanation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2801 was a bill that added a number of regulations to the RECR statutes and regulations, and gave the Department of Transportation civil penalty authority to enforce vehicle RECR regulations. You heard this bill on March 17th. Since then, there are the Dash 1 amendments. Most of the changes in the Dash 1 amendments are up until filling in the blanks of the amount of their RECR certificate are housekeeping. They take away two definitions, the definitions of destroy and the definition of wrecked vehicle. They require demolishing the plate instead of the term disposing of the plate before a vehicle is wrecked. They changed the words affidavit to certification. So pretty technical amendments. We get down to line 15 through 22 of the amendments. They fill in the blank so that a RECR certificate and a three-year renewal fee will be $958 for a single place of business, $230 for each additional place of business, and $30 for a duplicate certificate. It deletes a requirement that was in the original bill that RECRs attend an authorized training course, and authorizes the department to adopt any rules necessarily for an orderly transition from the one-year current certification to the three-year renewal cycle, and to phase in the on-site inspections if necessary, if those can't be done with existing resources before the renewals take effect the first time. Mr. Chair, this bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and Deb Elkins and one of the wrecking business owners are here if there's any questions, as well as Kelly Taylor from the Department of Transportation.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Where did 958?
I don't know. Maybe Deb can answer that for us.
958.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deb Elkins of the Northwest Automotive Trades Association. Kelly Taylor worked with us on the amendments, and the $958 is the same fee as the dealer licensing fee. And they're ballparking the amount that the additional staff that we're asking to help us with this, the implementation, they're ballparking what this thing's going to cost. We're wanting to pay our fair share.
Thank you, Deb. Is there any questions? Apparently not. Is there a motion to adopt the Dash 1s?
I will move to adopt the Dash 1s.
Representative Mabry moves that the Dash 1s to House Bill 2801 be adopted. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? They are adopted then.
I would move to House Bill 2801 with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means.
with a due pass.
With a due pass.
Representative Mabry moves House Bill 2801 with dash one amendments be sent to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll?
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Send it the Ways and Means.
But today.
I will open a work session on House Bill 3111. And Janet, can you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The purpose of the House Bill 3111 being on the agenda today is only for your consideration of sending it to the Judiciary Committee. The bill does create a Class C felony and for driving while suspended or revoked if the person causes an accident resulting in serious physical injury or death. Representative Close and Representative Williams with the Judiciary Committee have agreed to this exchange. So.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we refer House Bill 3111 to the House Judiciary Committee without recommendation.
Representative Mabry moves House Bill 3111 be referred to the Judiciary Committee without recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah.
Why without?
Wait, are we? I mean, this was an assignment to move it that way. Is that? I mean, are we supposed to not?
The,
I do have some feelings about this one.
Okay. The intent is, or the reason the chair of the Judiciary Committee asked us to refer it there because we're changing the felony level there, and it was okay with the sponsor. But now would be appropriate time to get your comments on record.
Well, I looked into this bill because I'm very much concerned for fiscal reasons that anything that moves to a felony and has consequences. But what I found when I did this is that it's really common for somebody not to really know that they've been suspended. But the whole question of the notification of suspension is turning into a big problem. And a lot of times people are driving with being suspended without literally ever having received, I'm not saying being notified, but having received notification that they are suspended. It turns out they're suspended for a variety of reasons. And there's a very large number. I mean, for example, the notification we just heard about with Representative Doyle's daughter that her license had been suspended because she hadn't filed a form. And there are, I mean, we think about the suspension being something really significant, you know, but there are lots of reasons that a license gets suspended and people end up driving it while suspended, and making it a felony, it seems to me, is a problem. On the other hand, I think it is appropriate for the Judicial Committee, for the Judiciary, to be the one that's discussing this. But it is more than
and
like a minor issue.
Representative, I'd certainly encourage
having put that in the record.
And I'd certainly encourage you whenever when and if this comes to a hearing there to give that testimony there. Okay. Representative, maybe?
I don't disagree, and I, you know, it's a good thing. My reason for recommending without a recommendation was simply that it will be heard in that committee, and they will hear the pros and cons, and be better to make that decision rather than us just pass it through without hearing, with a do pass or a don't pass recommendation.
I agree. So, I have no problem.
Any other discussion?
I appreciate your passion.
Well, I want to put it on the record.
Thank you. Any other discussion? And then, Ryan, will you call the roll?
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. And we'll close the work session and open a public hearing on House Bill 3240. And Janet,
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3240 would add a $10 assessment on traffic offense convictions, and it specifies the distribution of the revenue from the $10 for each conviction. 20% would go to the Safety Education Fund, and I believe this is an existing fund, if I get, yes, Safety Education Fund, and the remaining 80% would be distributed to the local government body if the citation is by a local law enforcement officer, and to the Oregon Traffic Safety Education Fund, a new fund, if the citation is by a state law enforcement officer. So this Oregon Traffic Safety Education Fund is established in the bill. The bill specifies that distributions to local bodies or the state fund be used for traffic safety education, traffic safety improvements, and traffic law enforcement. It also limits distributions from the Safety Education Fund, the current fund, to programs that are nonprofit, that have been found to be effective, and that operate statewide. It does also a reporting requirement in the bill, a new reporting requirement by the Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities on the use of the distributions from this fund. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you, Janet. I'm going to have Scott Bricker and Mark Lear and Catherine Sherlow. Okay, thank you.
Throw his voice out there. Make it sound like
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Bricker with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, represents bicyclists and interests of the bicycle industry. I'm actually here to introduce a panel of three speakers, and there's a number of other folks who want to testify on this bill as well. House Bill 3240 is something that the Oregon Transportation Safety Coalition, which the BTA is a member of, has been working on for a while with the City of Portland and some other jurisdictions as well. And basically, this bill, let's keep it brief, but will add fees to vehicle citations to create safety improvements today. Just one quick story. Last week, three people were killed in the town of Sandy, the city of Sandy, Oregon, in two different car crashes on the same day. Two people were seriously injured. One person was life-flighted to Emmanuel. And transportation safety is something that the Transportation Safety Coalition is very concerned about and very serious about. I want to introduce three speakers. The first one's going to be Mark Lear, who's the manager of the traffic investigations team at the City of Portland. Second one is Catherine Charlow, who's my boss, who's the executive director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And the third one is Joanne Fairchild, who hasn't been called up yet. And Joanne, you can have my seat if you want. And she's the director of the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Lear. I manage the City of Portland Office of Transportation's Traffic Investigations Group. The group that I manage is composed of traffic engineers, some project managers, some public outreach people, and basically we're the front lines of the handle all the angry phone calls from citizens that are concerned about traffic safety issues. We get about 30 to 40 calls per day. The majority of those have to do with speeding issues, pedestrian crossing issues, or where people have concerns about high accident locations or safety getting to transit or bus bike use. So it's really a struggle for us to deal with what ends up being thousands of calls per year wanting us to do something to address these problems. And so we've been really excited about the group that's come together to address these issues. And I wanted to basically just walk through three points pretty quickly. The first was to give you some background on how this developed from this grassroots and real diverse coalition. The second is to give you a sense of how immediately this bill we think can have some real major traffic safety benefits and allow us to provide much better customer service to those thousands of citizens that are calling us with real safety problems. And the fourth issue just is to give you some sense of why we think this bill is really moving in the right direction, providing a really good, accountable, collaborative process that's going to improve traffic safety. So on the first issue that Scott had just mentioned, the coalition that we have developed so far is really strong. It includes trauma nurses from the hospital side, the OHSU's Think First group, the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough group, and Oregon State Traffic Safety Group, Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and a really strong group of neighborhood associations. Over the last month, I went to every district coalition in the city of Portland. The representing 90 neighborhood associations, and I've never spoken in 15 years of my public service on an issue where there was more public support, where people were saying it makes a lot of sense to charge the violator to help us solve these problems, and we really would like to be at the table with you in figuring out how to spend these resources and even how to better allocate our enforcement efforts as well. Currently, there's a lot of feeling in the public that the current level of traffic fines aren't high enough to be a deterrent. And the last increase in the general moving violations wasn't in 1991. The legislature did some great things to improve the violations in school zones and also in construction zones, but the general increase, it's been quite a while. So we think that this change will immediately improve traffic safety. In the first place, is it really does make a major change in deterrence. Just to give you a couple statistics, in 1991, the maximum fine for going 44 miles per hour in a 25 mile an hour zone was set at $109. If you think about the loss of or the effect of wage increases, inflation, that $109 fine has gone down to about a $77 fine in current dollars. It's also a real common practice for judges in the state to reduce a fine by up to 50%. And so you can see that fine for going with potentially 44 miles an hour in a 25 mile an hour zone may actually start to feel more like a $39 ticket when it's all said and done. And if you think about the data that's out there that shows how damaging or how much more dangerous it is for a pedestrian who's struck by a vehicle or someone in an auto at these higher speeds, it really starts to make you think that the public's right to be really concerned about the deterrent value. Just a little bit on the statistics side, if you're struck by a vehicle that's going 45 miles per hour as a pedestrian, you have a less than a 10% chance of survival. At 20 miles per hour, the speed that we want people to be going in school zones, you've got a 95% chance of survival. And so that's a message that we really are trying to get out to the public, that is, when someone calls us and says someone's going 35 miles an hour on my 25 mile hour per street, and that person says, well, what's the big deal? I'm only going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. It really does make a huge difference. The same thing's true with red light running. There's just horrible data that's out there that shows that that this is the fastest growing part of traffic crashes, and that most of the fatalities end up being the non-violator, because that's the person that's getting T-boned. So there's just a lot of positive things we could do to address these issues. The way that the bill would work is 80% of the revenue that's generated by local police officers would go to the local communities that could go in enhancing services. And we're wanting to dedicate that money to engineering enforcement and education. The positive news is that there's a number of great services that are being provided by local governments that are pretty low cost. One of the greatest ones around enforcement is, I think every reasonable side jurisdiction in the state should require their police officers to sit down with their neighborhood associations, their bicycle pedestrian users, and say, here's where we plan to do our enforcement. Does that work with where you think it should be? And also talking to the traffic division at the same time. If they do that and they communicate that to judges, it just makes such a bigger difference to the community to understand that we're not doing we're not out there cherry picking and writing tickets to meet quotas. We're actually writing tickets where we have traffic safety problems and where there's real needs to address these issues. So that's basically my summary. Just to follow up on that, the bill does require, as Janet mentioned, that we report to the legislature on how the revenues are being used. We think that's real positive. And we're also looking at some potential amendments that would get at that issue of collaboration that I was just mentioning, because there's a lot of real potential to use this bill to actually make the enforcement process even more productive than it is now. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I am Catherine Sciarlo. I'm the executive director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and we are a statewide nonprofit organization working to promote bicycling and improve bicycling conditions in Oregon. We have about 3,000 members around the state, and we're also one of the founding members of the Oregon Traffic Safety Coalition. Mark did a great job kind of giving you an overview of the bill and a sense of some of the immediate improvements we could actually see on the ground. I want to talk a little bit about that 20% that goes into the educational programs at the statewide level and some of the safe routes to school programs that we can create out of that 20% and then also out of the other piece that goes to the state. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance has offered a bike safety program for middle school kids since 1998. We've taught about 12,000 kids in 17 communities. And what we've seen as we've worked with kids in schools around the state is, again and again and again,
Kids tell us we would like to walk to school, we would like to bicycle to school, but we can't because it isn't safe. And so we started to get that information and think, there's a real problem out there, and it's a problem that if we, as an organization that wants to see more bicycling, are going to be effective, we're going to need to start to address it. So we last legislative session put forward a bill that was passed. It was House Bill 3712. It was the Safe Routes to School bill. What that bill did was require local jurisdictions to confer, cities and counties to confer with school districts to identify hazards that keep kids from walking or bicycling to school safely. We were really pleased to see that bill pass, and I think what we saw as a part of that is a real feeling among legislators, among the people who testified, among the health and the public health community, that we want kids to be able to walk and bicycle. And I want to just share something that I've seen happen in rooms of 10 people or in rooms of 300 people, where the speaker will say, how many of you walked or bicycled to school when you were children? And in a room like this, probably most of us would raise our hands. And then the speaker will say, how many of you have or know children who walk or bicycle to school? And in a room like this, very possibly no one. Very possibly one person. Generally, you see one or two hands out of rooms of hundreds sometimes, 12 out of rooms of hundreds. So what that tells us is our communities are in dire need of safe ways to address traffic hazards. And we believe that this bill does that. And the nice thing about this bill is that it does it in a reasonable, fair, and intelligent way at a time of real fiscal difficulty. So we're excited to support it. And I want to just take that one step further in thinking about walking and bicycling to school. Obviously, it's important because it lends vitality to our communities and it gives our kids a chance to be independent. But it's also a pretty important emerging health problem. What we're seeing is that obesity and overweight among children in Oregon and around the country is rapidly increasing. I think in Oregon, the statistics are that 28% of eighth graders are overweight or obese. And that's obviously going to have health implications into adulthood, but it's got health implications now, too, as we see a skyrocketing rate of juvenile diabetes. And interestingly, the National Centers for Disease Control are telling us probably the very best way to address obesity and its related health issues among youth and among adults, for that matter, is in addressing the community conditions that allow people to use their bodies to walk and to bicycle. Clearly, if we're going to do that, if we're going to have the confidence to let our kids walk and bicycle, we need to address those hazards in the community. And that's one of the reasons we really support this bill. The education piece is quite exciting to us because, as I mentioned, last session we passed the bill that requires the coordination between local jurisdictions and school districts. Unfortunately, what we've seen is there has not been a great deal of implementation. The bill contained no implementing language and no resources to do so. So what we're excited about here is that this serves as kind of a logical next step. We've seen, in fact, in the communities where there have been some additional resources, and it can be a pretty small amount, that this collaboration process has happened and started to identify places where improvements need to be made, get them into local plans, sort of get the ear of local officials, and start to move us toward really addressing them. The health division gave out some mini grants. Those have been successful in helping to jumpstart that process. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance, as part of our bike safety program, has put resources into schools and helped to jumpstart the process around those schools. So we are really excited to see this opportunity to take the violator pays principle and do something, put a little bit of money into a place where it really is going to go a long way toward getting us to that place where our kids can walk and bicycle safely. And I will just say, as a mother of a six-month daughter, this is really starting to hit home to me. And as I look and I think about the way our community is going to look when she's ready to go to school, I very much want to see this kind of program kind of get us moving in that direction. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Joanne Fairchild. I am a trauma nurse coordinator responsible for injury prevention at Legacy Emanuel Hospital. I'm the director of the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program. And although I didn't put it on my testimony, I am also on the board for Oregon Safe Kids, and we voted in our last board meeting to support this legislation. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3240. I specifically want to address the 20% that goes into the Safety Education Fund. It was, I think, 10 years ago that we worked with Senator Gordon Smith when he was in the Oregon Senate and Senator Ron Cease to identify funding for traffic safety education programs that had gone through the federal grant cycle. And the problem with federal grant money is it's startup money, and it's 3 years and you're out. And unfortunately, although everybody says they value prevention, trying to actually get it funded is very difficult. And my program sits in a hospital, and when I'm successful, they make less money. And they're now losing money, and that makes it very difficult for them to support a nurse in the community when the needs at the bedside are so great. So we worked with them, and we were funded out of the criminal fees and assessments, which last session we were taken out of that, and our funding has been cut about 60%, I believe. Now it's more than 50%. The other thing that happened 2 years ago that didn't really have anything to do with the legislature, it was a constitutional issue, but we had a wonderful program called Oregon Students for Safety on the Move that worked throughout the state, and their funding source was deemed to be unconstitutional, and they lost their total funding. They are now defunct. Debbie Slover, who headed that program, is currently doing volunteer work out of her home. There are still some remnants of the student groups around the state, but they have no leadership and direction on a statewide level. So that's been a big problem. And there are many other programs, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance program, for instance, that have gone through this federal grant program. And we develop programs in this state that are wonderful. And it's no surprise that teenagers in our state, and this is from NHTSA, are much more likely than in any other state in the nation to be wearing their safety belt if they're in a bad crash. Our bicycle helmet use rate, thanks to the work of the legislature and the education that's going on, is higher than almost any place else in the nation. We've done wonderful work, but I'm afraid we're going to lose that if we don't find a way to have funding that continues these programs. It makes sense to me that the violator is the one that pays the cost. Every single year, according to Dr. John Tung, who's an orthopod who is very interested in traffic safety and on the Traffic Safety Commission for the state, did a study and found out that 9 out of 10 traffic deaths in our state are caused by people breaking traffic laws. Traffic laws are the most important laws that we have in this state to protect our families. And they're also the most broken. It will cost you a much bigger penalty if you throw a rock at my car than if you go through a red light and hit it. The fees, the penalties are much worse for property crimes than they are for traffic crimes, which are killing people. I now have to go into our elementary schools and tell our children that walk doesn't mean walk. Do you know why not? Because if they start across the street as soon as the signal changes to walk, they get killed by the adults, excuse me, that are running the red lights. We cannot allow ourselves to give our children a world they can't trust. And with safe routes to schools and the engineering money, I go into the schools and I tell our little kids that until they've had bicycle safety education and they know the rules of the road, they need to drive on the sidewalk, only they don't have any. And I tell them they need to cross on the crosswalks, and they don't have any. I slow way down for school zones and neighborhoods, because I know if it's a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit, that's to protect our children. they think cars can stop as fast as people can. So a child will just run right into the street, no matter what we've told them about that, because they believe we big people in those big things will stop. And I slow way down, and I have people sitting on my back bumper honking their horns and flipping me off. And I want to stop and say, where are you going that's more important than the lives of these children? This bill makes sense. We can give our children a safer state, and the people that pay the cost are the ones that break these absolutely essential laws. I do not believe that the legislature passes laws that are not important, and I think they need to be followed. And if people then can't afford to break the traffic laws, wonderful. My goal is not to collect any money at all, because all the people in the state follow these laws and keep our kids safe. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Joanne. Susan?
Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Susan Schneider from the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to comment here. Now that you've heard an overview of what we want to try and accomplish and why it's so important, we'd like to let you know that there are several issues that we're working on resolving or developing amendments to address. Those include making the surcharge optional for local jurisdictions, second, dealing with the cost for any changes to the court computer systems to accommodate it. Third, making the surcharge applicable to all tickets and not just those that are contested. We also want to deal with the role of the local traffic safety collaboration that Mark mentioned, and also the structure of the account for receiving the money in ODOT. We still need to work on that. We expect to complete this work within the next week and come back to you with appropriate proposed amendments and ask for a work session at that time on House Bill 3240. So thank you for your attention this morning.
Thank you for being here in testifying today. Committee questions?
This is obviously a very serious safety issue, and rightfully so. So I wonder why you would be offering amendments that would make it optional.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, because some local jurisdictions have their own traffic courts, and some local jurisdictions operate off the state system. City of Portland, we use the circuit court as our municipal court. And for those who have their own municipal court, they have the authority to do this on their own. And so this is to avoid any conflict in the law about that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last session we had this other bill. We were trying to get people to walk and ride to school. And we heard the negative part of that was it wasn't getting hit on a bicycle or walking from a car. It was the fact that the kids were getting kidnapped on the way to school. And I have 10 grandkids, and 8 of them live around Woodburn. And we discourage walking to school or riding to school. The district does, because they got the buses for that, and they have a safety factor. So I think that's something you're going to have to convince everybody, because in today's environment, you spoke of your little daughter. When she gets to be 8 or 9 years or 10 years old, will you let her walk to school alone someplace? I mean, those are real concerns. And I'm a bicycler, so I believe riding the bike. And
yeah,
we walked to school because we never had cars, or we wouldn't have one. But the times are different, and I think the safety is a concern, but I think it's also a concern on how we protect those kids when they go to school from these beasts that kill kids and kidnap them.
Representative Zahner, one of the ideas that we've had in the state that we would like to pursue but have not had the funding is a program called Walking School Buses. Mm-hmm. And you work with senior citizens in your community to have these places. They walk through the neighborhood picking up the kids and walk the kids to school. It gets our seniors out in the world, gets them some exercise, gets them contact with children, gets our children contact with a generation that not all our children are around their grandparents. So it gets them that, but we haven't had the funding to do that. And that's one of the things we would love to do that addresses both the exercise issue and the safety issue.
Representative Zahner, can I just provide just one other anecdote that sort of applies to this, which I found really interesting. And when I was going on meeting with all the sister coalitions, this really nice guy came up to me and said, who lived in East Portland, I finally saved up enough money. I bought a house. It was six blocks from where I currently was living. I could move with my wife the six blocks, and our family now could live in this great house. We were so excited to be able to stay in the neighborhood. But what we found out when we moved the six blocks is we'd gone over the border from where they bus kids into school, and now their kids had to walk to school. And he was really frustrated, saying, but my kids have to, or they could walk six blocks, and they could get on the bus. The bus isn't even full. Why can't they do that? He also said, I've looked at the data on where sex offenders are, and where he lives is in the part of the county that has the highest per capita sex offenders. Mm-hmm. And so these are major issues that are issues that when we do these Safe Routes to School projects, we have conversations about, but there's all kinds of complications, but it's definitely one that we're paying attention to, and if we have the resources, hopefully we can address these issues better than we've been able to.
And Chair Brown, Representative Zahner, if I could answer that real quickly as well. One of the things we're very clear on is that this little bit of money is not going to solve our problem, and it's not in itself going to get kids able to walk and bicycle to school. What we find so exciting about this approach, though, is bringing the players together, bringing the people in the school districts, bringing people in the schools, bringing parents, bringing community members, people from the transportation departments together to really look at the problem. And that's clearly going to be the first step we need to take before we can tackle any of those big looming issues.
Mr. Waller, one more follow-up regarding revenue. The state of Oregon is owed a lot of money, and in the transportation department, you know, this bugs me because I got a bill to try to figure out how to collect some of this stuff. $17 million, a little over $17 million owed to the transportation department. Your cut would be $3.5 million. So we need to figure out, if we do find these people, we got to collect the money. And I realize they're not in the collection business, so we're trying to revise that and work on it. Because that money's sitting there, and I can see $3.5 million is yours right there, and
it
doesn't make sense to me. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenwood.
Yes, I just want to comment, Mr. Chair. This group's obviously done a good job of informing the public on this. I think I've gotten more email to urge me to support 3240 from my constituents, not from around the world, than I have on any bill yet. So I congratulate you on your grassroots support for this, but it would be nice if you turned it off, too. Well, actually, I like to hear from my constituents, so no, I have them on my email list then, but you... it's been a flood.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I'd just like to address Representative Zahner's concern, because one of the schools in my district received a grant for the Safe Routes to Schools implementation, and I participated in a moving school bus example. It was really fun. It was one day where they got lots of folks from the community to come out, and it was just wonderful to see this whole sense of community built around how to get kids in the community, you know, safely to their homes and back to school. And there were grandparents, there was all, you know, types of folks. It was wonderful. So, and it's going to be a little bit easier, obviously, in urban areas than in rural areas. And I think that's something that for rural legislators, this is a problem in urban districts as well. I mean, there are parts of my district in incorporated, you know, city of Portland that have no sidewalks. So it's not just going to be rural areas, but it's also urban areas as well. I mean, the unincorporated parts that formerly were unincorporated parts of Multnomah County, that when annexation happened, those improvements did not happen. And so we have some big concerns in the urban areas as well as rural areas. But that's a great program. We were fortunate to get the grant, but it was only for one school out of my entire district. So I really think that's a wonderful idea. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Gilman.
It may be in this testimony, but I haven't heard the number. What's your guesstimate of how much this will raise?
Representative Gilman, our estimate, actually Troy Castillo from ODOT has done an estimate. I think that they said that there were 550,000 moving violations at a $10 surcharge, has the potential getting at what Representative Zahner was saying of generating $5.5 million. I think what Troy will tell you is that we conservatively say we might only get a third or half of that revenue back. So it's probably more like a $2 to $3 million number.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Janet, you have one?
Yeah, I was just going to clarify that this is on convictions, not just if you get a citation.
Right, right.
And the other thing I was going to see if I think it's confusing when I read the bill that the two funds are so closely named. I think there'll be confusion with the general public or with other legislators beyond this if you can do anything about that.
Mr. Chair, Susan Schneider, to respond to Janet's comment, yes, and I think there's also some problems just administratively with it structured that we will work with ODOT to clarify what works for them.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for being here and testifying today. Jacob? And Rex Burkholder? And we'll have those two next.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to welcome my very own Metro Counselor to this hearing today, Mr. Burkholder.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Brown and Committee. I'm Rex Burkholder. I am Metro Counselor for Mitch Greenlick. Actually, I'm Metro Counselor for the northern part of Portland. You come here not representing the council today because the council hasn't taken a position on this bill. We haven't considered this one. I come because I have a long interest in making our community safer for bicycling and walking. I served for 8 years on ODOT's Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee advising the Department of Transportation on how best to, what policies and what programs and projects would best make the community safer for biking and walking. A major piece of work we did was an annual grant program where we had a couple million dollars of varied year by year, of course, that we gave out to local communities that would come in and ask for assistance on putting sidewalks and bikeways in and such. And a major focus was always on schools. And many times it was in smaller communities, Madras, Sisters, to name a few, Pendleton, where they had built new schools that were outside the town center. And then they discovered that unfortunately Highway 26 is not a very comfortable place for kids to walk and bike to school. And they had come to the state and asked for some help in terms of providing wider shoulders or pathways to the schools outside of the communities. So I've been aware of this issue for quite a long time. Also have two children who are not so young anymore, but when I got started working on these issues, it was really inspired by taking my five-year-old on his first bike ride to downtown Portland from my neighborhood, which is not very far, a mile and a half or so, but realizing that without bike lanes and without good facilities, a five-year-old was really in danger on a road that I felt comfortable on as an adult riding. But, of course, I knew the traffic rules. I knew how cars operate and such. A five-year-old will stop in the middle of the road and turn around and ask you a question. And you can't do that in the middle of a traffic lane. So I've worked for a number of years to help get bicycle lanes and such throughout the state as well as in Portland area. And you've heard a lot of the good arguments here. My testimony, written testimony, talks a lot about the health impacts. And one thing that Metro does work on a lot is to try to create walkable and bikeable communities. So it's both a land use issue but also transportation. So people can walk out their door and get to the grocery store, the post office, walk to the bus stop to pick up a bus, or take care of most of their needs. Their kids can also walk to school. And we work quite a bit on that in the Metro area. This is a tool I think would really help. Because what we're facing right now, because the gas tax hasn't been increased for quite a few years, and the fact that inflation's eaten up that whatever gains you had in the budgets for transportation, that communities used to build sidewalks, they used to put bike lanes in, they used to put traffic calming in, they had money to actually go out and do these improvements. Now basically cities and counties are stuck doing maintenance of the existing facilities and very little modernization. When we did some money like the OTIA money, the Oregon Transportation Improvement Act of last session, that's great. But I mean, that's, and the federal dollars that Metro helps distribute, that's great. But it's a very small drop in the bucket. And most communities have stopped doing their traffic calming projects. They stopped doing the pedestrian improvement projects. There's just not money. And I think that's one thing that's really critical about this one here. For all the reasons you've heard earlier, it's that we need a new source of money that can be directed to these types of projects. course, we'd love to see a transportation funding package come out of the legislature that deals with all our transportation funding problems. But this is a small area that a small amount of money can actually make a big difference in. And so that's my testimony, is very strongly supporting this. I think it's a good bill and a good way to achieve this end. And if you have any questions about Metro or whatever, we can talk later.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Jacob Brostoff. I'm the transportation advocate with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We're a statewide nonprofit advocacy organization. We work to strengthen Oregon's growth management program. And my written testimony speaks to a lot of the issues raised by previous testifiers, so I'll spare everyone the tedium of hearing me repeat the public health arguments and the arguments about children being able to get to school on their own steam. I wanted to pick up on a few things that Councillor Burkholder said and then add a little bit of information that we now have about polling on these issues. I wanted to point out that I think really safe routes to schools and these kinds of investments go far beyond just helping children get to school, and they're a really important growth management tool. Every time we add a sidewalk or a bike lane to our communities, we're creating the opportunity for all of our residents to choose a different way of traveling. And that benefits everyone. That creates space on the roads for freight. That saves us air pollution. It means that we get exercise when we move around our communities. And it helps people like Metro help local governments put shopping and work closer to where people live so that people don't have to travel as far to do the things they need to do every day. So I think that... we would like, 1,000 Friends would like, for the committee to think about this bill not just as benefiting children, although clearly that's a primary benefit, but also benefiting all Oregonians and all of our communities. And then I just wanted to also draw your attention to a poll that we released yesterday in partnership with the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition and the Surface Transportation Policy Project. It was a nationwide poll, and it showed that voters overwhelmingly support spending money on these kinds of projects. And in fact, 74% of the respondents in the poll supported funding safe routes to schools. So there's clearly a significant amount of public support for these kinds of programs. So we urge you to pass this bill along and help it move into law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Got off easy this morning. Thank you.
Mr. Brown, Chair Brown, I just want to make a comment about that this is not just safety for children, and share just a brief story with the committee members. I, prior to being here in Salem, I worked downtown and was every day walking downtown as a pedestrian, and it was very challenging across the streets in downtown Portland. I will say that there needs to be, I believe, some education for drivers about who has the right of way in crosswalks when the light is clearly green. And I will say that it was very frustrating and challenging at times, and so to emphasize again that this is not just for children, it's to educate all drivers about safety for adults as well. But there was a older man who every day I would see walking around downtown, and one day I realized I didn't see him. I saw him every day walking, and I read in the paper that he had been hit and killed in crossing the street right in front of my office building because a driver, and witnesses said that this older gentleman had the right-of-way and somebody came and plowed through, and it's really sad, and it just struck me what a waste. Unfortunately, this older gentleman was just a wonderful man and had prided himself in every day having breakfast at the diner right downstairs in our building, and it was just sad to me because the fact is that, you know, this was unfortunately something that could have been prevented. So I think not just for children's sake, but for adults who want to use, you know, sidewalks, that we need to educate drivers that this is a real problem. And it was frustrating for many of us because, you know, it's hard to make sure that drivers get this message. And that's what we need to do. And I think the only way we can do that is increased education. Thank you for indulging me on that story.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yes, can I have Troy Costellas and Andrea Vogt, please? Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll be brief this morning. Just want to say that the League of Cities very much supports moving forward with the concept in House Bill 3240. We, of course, are very interested in not only the safe routes to school, but the many traffic safety issues that we have in cities. And we did work on House Bill 3712 last session, which got a start in terms of addressing safe routes to school. We think this is a very good way to continue that discussion and put some funding around the issue. As was mentioned in the previous testimony, there are some issues that we still need to work out, particularly making this discretionary. As you heard from Susan Schneider with the City of Portland, there are differences in the way that the court system, basically, for municipalities, and so we need to make sure that is addressed. But again, very much support moving forward with this concept. Thanks.
Thank you, Andrea. Troy.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And Representative Greenlick really hit one of the nails on the head there, in that this coalition came together and did a great job of bringing something fairly comprehensive and grassroots and locally driven. What's amazing to me is that in some cases these groups compete for a very small, scarce source of money through my office. And here they all are all sitting together at the table, together arm in arm in bringing this toward for you to debate. One comment I will make right out of the gate is that there are other states that do similar. State Tour North in Washington has a similar program in relationship to their school zones. They have a program where the added fine or the double fine in the school zones goes to, in their state, the Washington Traffic Safety Commission, our counterpart, to do work for school zone safety. So, this is not something that's unique. You're not necessarily breaking ground in debating this bill and looking at it. I've been in my position for 5 years, and during that whole time, one of the things that I've been concerned about is the fact that I have federal highway safety dollars that come through with strings and directions and try and get it out to local communities and all these different needs, but there isn't necessarily always any other fund where programs that run out of eligibility under the Highway Safety Program can go off and be on their own. They have to get donations or from insurance companies or solicit other places. And sometimes what we see is these programs that have done a great job, a year or two after they've ended under our program, don't exist anymore. And AWESOME was one of those programs that you heard mentioned here, middle school, high school program. The bill does create two accounts, very similar names, but with very different purposes. And if the bill was to become law as written, you can basically put your trust in me and my office. We know how to, we can work through this and make sure everything goes well. We're dealing with 16 different accounts today. This would add a couple more, but we would make sure that we're using the funds correctly. How much volume does this bill generate into the different accounts? As was mentioned, if we used 550,000 convictions per year, you have a maximum of about 5.5 million. But we hear from courts that they typically only collect about a third, maybe a half. So any of the numbers that we've been able to generate for you in the fiscal, that's the maximum potential. And if the courts have issues, you've got to bring that down. What would occur? Well, the existing safety education fund would likely receive about $1.1 million per year, and that's to deal with a lot of the programs that you saw here that we have that have been under the federal funds and are no longer eligible. The Traffic Safety Education Fund in ODOT Safety Division would receive maximum about $440,000. The local jurisdictions, back through their courts, the maximum that would be distributed is about $4 million. The various city and county entities. The funds are split into three different buckets, and so that's what occurs. My office would be looking at about $1.5 million a year maximum between the two accounts. It does give my office a non-highway fund resource. So that's one also thing about being part of the department. Quite often, if we deal with some issues, and all of you have had constituents that have brought things up that are relating to a roadway, anytime that I'm trying to work on them with from the safety division, I reach over and ask highway to help. A lot of times we're bound and limited by the Constitution, and we're dealing with state roads. So then I've got to go to people such as some of the presenters before and say, can we use some of the local money because of the highway fund issue and the separation of city, county, and state? There are a lot of great programs. As you've heard before, we are on a very good streak in relationship to the number of fatalities and injuries in this state, and a lot of it is due to the education and prevention work by many of the coalition members that brought this forward. My hope is that something like this fund allows me to be a partner in it as well, and not have to be the person, unfortunately, that writes that letter and says your grant's ending September 30 of whatever year because of no longer having highway safety funds. And with Congress debating the next reauthorization, we're not sure how much we're going to get. We've got every single incentive dollar the last 6 years under T21. I don't know what we're going to get next reauthorization because we haven't seen the bill that Congress is looking at doing for transportation and toward safety. One last point, and that is the Senate has passed Senate Bill 179, and that bill is dealing with the when children are present and school zone definition, and I think it's likely pending for you in this committee to debate as you move into dealing with Senate bills. It has an impact on cities and counties in relationship to signing, the information on the sign, but it's to make the area around schools much more clear to the driver of when you need to be doing 20 miles an hour and when you don't. Instead of leaving it up to the driver discretion and they come into an area too fast, then see the child and it's too late because they're already past the signs. The Senate Transportation Economic Development Committee worked on a bill to help clarify that for you and I as drivers and also for our kids. And this type of fund, if passed and set up under the way the bill currently reads, would allow cities and counties to use some of that money to deal with that issue in order to, in particular, to make areas around our schools much clearer to the drivers. There's a lot in this bill, which is amazing for only being a page and a half. There's a lot of complexity in it, and Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than happy to try and answer any questions you or committee members may have.
Thank you, Troy. Questions? Representative Dingville.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually do have a couple of questions for Troy. And you may have stated this, and it just I didn't pick up on it, but I'm reading the measure summary. And in the background, it talks about currently the Safety Education Fund is funded by the Criminal Fines and Assessment Public Safety Fund. So can you explain how much you currently get from that? And that isn't under your jurisdiction. Is that right? It's the Department of Education.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, the current Safety Education Fund is in the Safety Division for me to allocate.
Okay.
It was funded for the last 10 years by an allocation from the Criminal Fines Assessment Account. Last session, the Ways and Means Committee and through, I think it was House Bill 5051, reset the Criminal Fines Assessment Account for the Police Academy and their building, moved the Safety Education Fund out of there and created an income from the General Fund, and at the same time cut the allocation in half. We were receiving about $400,000 to use for these programs. Last biennium it got to cut to about $190,000 general fund, and through the five special sessions, the current allocation for this biennium dropped all the way down to about $165,000 general fund. Currently before the Ways and Means Committee for the Safety Education Fund for the 0305 biennium is to remove all of the general fund out, and as you probably heard some information about, and I think the common name is the Lawnmower Fund, the Transportation Operating Fund, is to put about, I didn't bring it with me, but I think it's about $190,000 of that Lawnmower Fund to the Safety Division to continue the programs that are there for 0305. So hopefully all around about I got your questions.
Just a follow-up clarification. So currently, you're saying it sounds like the funding is really tenuous for this program if we don't look for a dedicated revenue source that this bill would provide because of the competition with...
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dingfelder, that is correct. If the legislature and the Ways and Means Committee decides to use the Lawnmower Fund to deal with other issues within the department, the question is, will the Ways and Means Committee continue to earmark that $180,000 or so for the Safety Education Fund? That is a legislative decision.
Okay. Thank you. That helps clear that up.
Or any other questions?
Well, I just
looked like you're
talking about my revenue again here. I think 23,000 accounts that we haven't collected from. So I think I'm trying to work it so the Bicycle Alliance can go out and collect that and keep all that money. Would you have any objection to that? Not just 20%, all of it.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you guys for testifying this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll close the public hearing on 3240, and that pretty well wraps up our business today. Janet gave me a note here that 9 o'clock on Friday.
Wow. Okay.
And next Monday at 8:30.
You got a date or something in the morning?
No, we're
here at 8:30.
And 2 o'clock in the afternoon also. We'll have two meetings Monday.
Would you repeat that?
Okay, Janet.
Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to.
8:30.
We're going to start at 6 in the morning now. Jane Feller didn't know.
Janet's got an announcement.
I just want to pass out something for the record on the first bill we did today, House Bill 2999. It's the Department of Transportation's testimony, and the bill that was the gasoline bill, we did at the end, and it is limited to gasoline tax. It doesn't include.
Doesn't include diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet.
Thank you.
Shut up.